is the Grinlian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grinlian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grinlian Bunker, welcome one and all. I am Micah Hanks, and you've locked in to the one and only Grinlian Report. Always my honor, privilege, and pleasure to be able to be here with you as we broadcast live. Remember, all you live listeners out there, if you're not already tuning in, it's 7 p.m. on Monday nights now via the Worldwide Global Radio Alliance, KGRARadio.com. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, along with our very special and everlasting co-host and producer, Mr. Chris Hayes, also in studio tonight. Good evening, Mr. Hayes.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm good, but I'm quite chilly. As I understand, it is snowing above ground outside the bunker.
Absolutely. It is snowing.
Well, we are bunkering down and staying warm, and we're going to warm you up with the latest news that's happening tonight. All that's fit for print in the world of the strange, the unusual, some breaking news from time to time. And, of course, we're also going to be analyzing during hour two. Claims of extraterrestrial contact. Have we been visited? Now, I generally am not a proponent of this, but I'm a person who tries to remain open-minded, and many proponents of the extraterrestrial hypothesis as it relates to UFO research would maintain that, yes, we have been visited, and there is clear evidence. So we're going to look at the evidence, and we're going to see if we can convince ourselves, Chris and I, the believers, skeptics, is that what they call us now?
Yeah, I prefer the people skeptics.
The peoples.
Because it makes us sound like the socialist commies we are.
Yes, that's right. Exactly. Well, let's get right into the news. Here's what's been happening in Ferguson, Missouri. A story that we have continued to hear about. Many people don't want to hear any more about. It's a great concern. And at present, this is all we have to report about this. Missouri Governor Jay Nixon has activated the state's National Guard and declared a state of emergency. USA Today reports, this is in advance of a grand jury decision in the case of a white police officer who shot and killed a black teenager. Widely publicized, most folks know what's going on here. We won't get into that aspect of it, but the order in effect for 30 days will instruct the St. Louis County Police Department, the Missouri State Highway Patrol, and the St. Louis Metro Police to work together in a unified command to keep the peace should public reaction to the decision turn violent.
Well, have you heard what the KKK has said in response to this?
No, I haven't, actually.
Not in direct response to the state of emergency, but the I guess it's the Missouri local. I don't know how they structure the Ku Klux Klan, but the local KKK chapters have said that they will line the streets and use lethal force on all protesters who they feel are you know, acting in an aggressive manner.
Oh my God. And they will do what? They will be taken to jail too, right?
Absolutely. After this happened, though, the best part was, I've been following this particular story for a while.
I think I know what's coming.
After this happened, Anonymous hacked the Ku Klux Klan's Facebook and Twitter account. They created another one. Anonymous hacked that one as well and started publicizing first and last names of all the members in the KKK roster for that locale.
Wow, unbelievable. You know, I wonder sometimes, because the mind does reel, how in the modern world can there still be an organization like the Ku Klux Klan? Oh yeah, that's right, freedom of speech, but that doesn't really justify what they do, does it? Pretty damned awful, in my opinion now, and I think the opinion of most people. But, of course, you know, the government there in Missouri is directing police, people actually by jurisdiction of law, to be able to carry out such things as, again, there are a lot of people who would just jump right to an assault against the citizenry. Now, that's hopefully not what's going to happen, but, I mean, things could get nasty, I guess. But they, quote, have said that they've been directed to protect civil rights and ensure public safety in the city of Ferguson and St. Louis. Now, that's all to say about that. It's breaking news, and I did want to touch on it. But on to other news that's been making headlines this week. Scientists raised hopes on Monday that as the Philae lander nears the sun, its solar panel-powered battery will actually recharge. Remember, this has been a momentous week with regard to the comet landing operation. This has been something about a decade or more in the making. And since landing, of course, with a bounce, as was reported on Wednesday, Philae has already sent back reams of data that scientists are eagerly examining, but there were fears its mission would be cut short because, well, unfortunately, the necessity for being able to power the operation. And we're talking about powering an operation on a comet some 10 years away from Earth. So hence the fears that it would be cut short because of this situation. You're probably wondering, well, what kind of a battery is powering this thing? Well, of course, it's solar power. But what happened was that Philae, of course, came to rest in the shadow of a cliff, and hence the signal went silent Saturday after its primary battery went out and was no longer being fed by solar energy. But it is hopeful that indeed, as the comet, as the world turns, but you know, really in this case, I guess as the floating space rock turns, that hopefully our little lander buddy is going to be able to catch the power of the sun yet again. But again, it's been a very momentous week, and it's been extremely exciting. The European Space Agency's kept us up to date on all kinds of things that have been happening and all the kinds of things that have been learned. I want to come back around after a little bit of audio to some of the things people claim we've been gathering about this in the last few days.
The signal has been reestablished with the comet, and that shows that Philae is working. We don't quite know where Philae is yet, but the fact that there is radio contact means that all systems seem to be go. There's certainly been quite a lot of data come back from some of the instruments on board the Philae lander, and the instrument scientists are all busy poring over those and trying to find out what they mean. So it's, yeah, a lot more cheerful faces around the place this morning.
Cheerful faces indeed. Now, they have said, okay, ESA agents say that we are very confident at some stage it will wake up again and we can achieve contact. With what? Did you hear this bit? As a matter of fact, Grayley and X listeners have already heard this, Chris, but there has been a, well, it's actually confirmed that there's sort of a signal that's been produced by the comet, some sort of a kind of a, well.
It sounds like a chirp almost.
Yeah, it's been likened to a song. But I saw Michael Sala, and I've seen a lot of the exopolitical advocates saying that what we've really known all along is that aliens were trying to communicate with us, and that this space rock.
Was it like a relay tower?
Yeah. You know, they're even saying that. Chris, they're even saying that there is a relay tower. Basically, I've had some of our good friends, actually, friends of the program who send us news stories every other day or so, have linked to this. And, our buddy Milton in South Carolina had said, you know, one of these photos does appear to show some sort of a strange object. So, now I guess what we do have to keep in mind is that maybe perhaps there are also objects that may appear in the foreground that are actually a part of the lander itself. But the thing is that many are saying that more specific to the comet itself, that this reverberating, chirping song that it seems to produce is actually a signal, a.k.a. the likes of 2001, a monolith that's broadcasting into space, and we've actually gone to intercept an alien message.
Well, I mean, yeah, there's a non-zero chance that that is the case, but do these people not realize that every astrological body in the universe, up to and including the universe itself, makes noise?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, electromagnetic fluctuations, I mean, these kinds of things can occur in all different sorts of situations. As a result of a number of things. I mean, it can be minerals and, you know, metallic, substructure or composition of such, you know, said space rock. I mean, there are any number of things, and those things have actually been accounted for in relation to this comet. But yet again, I find that often what people tout as being evidence of alien intervention is essentially something that has been interpreted as being such and generally counter to a consistent far less compelling narrative that is offered by science agencies, which are commenting on said, you know, situation, in this case, it being a singing comet.
You know, in instances like this, I weep for the conspiracy theorists and the people who think, you know, it's an alien relay tower or whatever it is, and they're ignoring the clear and just phenomenally miraculous implications that this is. We landed a probe on a moving comet.
Yeah.
Traveling faster than speeds the majority of spaceships we've ever created could travel. This could be like a ferry to other parts of the galaxy, saving fuel, saving man hours. We hitched a ride on an intergalactic taxi.
Yeah.
And people aren't talking about that. We could go to Jupiter. We could go...
And beyond the infinite.
All over the place.
Yeah.
But with this, the implications are limitless within the realm of real hard science.
They really are, you know. And again, there are people who, you know, when I was on George Noory's Beyond Belief recently, at the time that I actually viewed the preview, I actually was allowed to log in and actually watch the program, but it had already gone live. And one thing I got to say about George Noory is he is, I find him to be an extremely balanced person. You know, when I'm talking and I want to talk about skepticism, you know, I actually said to him at one point, I said, George, you know, often I'm more of the skeptical ilk. He says, of course, you've got to be. You know, he's not someone who wants you to you know, pander to believers. But by the same token, I try to also prevent or rather to present what I believe to be the most compelling evidence that actually supports what may indeed be anomalous activity that falls under the category of UFOs. I certainly think that there's a phenomenon. We've talked about this, and the listeners of this show know this very well. But at the time that I viewed the episode, there were four comments. Two of them were really, really good, and then two of them were pretty negative. One, and again, this is kind of what we're going to get into during the second hour. The second comment was, it wasn't, you know, derogatory or mean or anything that was just character assassination, but it was in disagreement with my skepticism about UFOs and their origin, what they may be. Or rather, not even so much skepticism, just my open-mindedness in truth toward the possibles, rather than accepting that it's all one thing, aliens are visiting. And the person who had responded had said, you know, where's this guy been for the last, you know, 50 years? I mean, most of us are way past trying to prove what UFOs are, where they're from. We already know that they're here. Now we're just trying to understand, you know, how we relate with our space brothers. And I'm just kind of thinking, again, what is your knowledge of ufology based on that leads you to, I mean, completely, you know, we're not just dunking for apples. I mean, we're taking a bath. I mean, this is like, wow, we know aliens are here, and now how do we deal with it? You know, as a matter of fact, Stephen Bassett a few years ago in Fate Magazine wrote an article, and it was calling for the end of ufology, but not like I've kind of rather tongue-in-cheek written about in you know, my website. He had actually said, we need to end the study of UFOs. And his idea about this was quite simply this. He says, there's no point in continuing to discuss whether UFOs exist. We're beyond that. We know they're here. It's the exopolitical age. Now what we do is, he says, UFO research needs to be replaced with research into how we can relate better to the aliens. And I'm thinking, the aliens that we've all, of course, seen and we, of course, can acknowledge exist, because, I mean, there's so much hard evidence that supports. Now, there's some compelling evidence that certainly suggests an extraterrestrial component. There is the testimony of a number, you know, hundreds, thousands of people out there who claim to have had encounters with what they perceive to be exotic, non-human intelligences. You know, we'll get to that a little bit later, because I do want to address that. And I'm open-minded to an extent. I think, actually, you have to be fundamentally open-minded at all costs. It's just that you cannot just say, well, people say that they've seen an alien. You know, again, did they see this thing jump off of an aircraft? And did they hear this thing tell them, yes, I am from this planet? Now, that did happen an awful lot back in the 50s, you know, but again, with the Space Brothers, you know, and with your, you know, your Adamskis and a lot of the popular contactees, again, it was very obvious, sadly, that George Adamski was completely making that up. I mean, of all people, you know, one of the very people who had helped debunk that had been Ray Palmer, who had been the editor of Amazing Stories, later founded Fate Magazine. Big-time advocate of this whole Shaver mystery thing, but Ray Palmer had said, folks, you got to know, before it was Orthon, you know, before it was coming from planet Venus, that manuscript that became Adamski's book that was published after the advent of the quote-unquote saucer age, Ray Palmer said, that book was sent to me, but it wasn't Orthon or whoever, it was Jesus Christ who came down, not on a flying saucer, but just on a more generic spaceship. He changed everything in a book that had already been written, and he was pitching at me, you know, probably years, maybe a decade beforehand, and it eventually got published, but only after the popularity of flying saucers, and only after he changed it from Jesus Christ coming down in a spaceship to a quote-unquote man from Venus who was warning, you know, humankind, and picked, of course, Adamski. There are people who still believe that George Adamski was in contact in the desert back in the 1950s. You know, and again, sadly, that story predates this whole flying saucer meme. He changed it all around to fit a common, and at the time, growing in popularity, in fact, a very popular meme that had been presented. And so these things have to be taken into consideration. You know, it's not to say that we can attack the character of every individual who claims they've had contact, but we have to be very careful which characters we listen to. But maybe there is some compelling information. Maybe we'll talk about that. And I definitely, a little later, want to get into some of the stuff about Boyd Bushman. We have not talked about this on this show. As a matter of fact, I have avoided talking about it. But I think that at this point, it's more than enough justification to address this story there are certainly some problems with it. But before we get to that, I do want to mention to people, if you're not already a listener of the Middle Theory podcast, it's a free podcast that Christopher McCollum and I produce just as well on a weekly basis. It covers more news and events, but we do deal a lot with conspiracies. And so the listenership of the Grailian Report no doubt would enjoy this podcast. But I'm going to tell you, one of the key stories we featured this past week was this story about the FBI crime statistics that were reported for the state of Connecticut and the fact that zero deaths were listed in relation to Sandy Hook Elementary School. And the reason I say in relation to Sandy Hook is because what was listed was in the town of Newtown, Connecticut for 2012, there was a great big fat zero by murders and non-negligent homicides for Newtown for the entire year of 2012. InfoWars, Chris, InfoWars carried this story. Okay.
Of course they did.
And they said, well, folks, what's this? You know, is this an admission by the FBI? How are we to interpret this information? Well, somebody sent me this link and I looked at it and I thought, there's got to be data that somebody's overlooking. So I said to Chris McCollum was actually here in the bunker with me that night and we were doing some work for that week's upcoming show. And I said, Chris, look at this. He gets on the website and within about 15 minutes, we're sitting there drinking a beer and very casually, you know, he's actually, I told him, you know, as you're looking, let me transcribe what you're finding, and I'm going to look just as well. I think I pulled up a state municipal pamphlet that, first of all, was actually dedicated to the memory of the children and the other victims at the Sandy Hook shooting. Okay, so there were certainly state agencies that were overseeing this, and this is where the catch comes into play here, is the fact that you got to keep in mind, this information that was reported to the FBI was actually from city government, okay, city police. State agencies had actually managed the investigation into the shooting. Chris goes to the FBI fact sheet. He doesn't scroll down the page. He actually has to find a different fact sheet, but he finds one that lists information for state, tribal, and other agencies that are basically operated on a state level. And sure enough, the information there reported coincided with the number of deaths that were reported in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012. And the crime sheet that's maintained at FBI.gov not only accounted for the deaths of the people at Sandy Hook, but also for other rifle-related killings that were reported, just not reported in the place where InfoWars and other people had hoped to find that data, or maybe in this case hoped not to find that data. And we went back. It was so easy to find the information. We go back. InfoWars.com, that article was posted in September. They have not yet updated. They haven't even tried to look for the information. Think about that. Think about how horrible the memory of the lives lost, especially school children, you know, be damned, unfortunately, because we want to pander this idea to people that, well, this is what really happened. Now, I will say there have been some pretty strange things that have been, especially in relation to what people call crisis actors and things like that, that have been alleged. I've even wondered about some of that footage. I really, truly have. But, I mean, all the data that's, again, you know, InfoWars, anybody else wants to try and say that the FBI had secretly, very quietly admitted there was nothing to see here. No murders reported. Oh, yeah, they were. You just didn't look in the right place.
So what you're saying is that there are separate and distinct sets of statistics kept for certain and specific reasons?
Yeah, and the reason...
And they're not all on one single piece of paper?
Yeah, you got to do a little digging.
Oh, my God. My whole life is a lie.
Yeah, well, we did an entire breakdown, and so you can check that out on the Middle Theory the podcast, but at the website, we also have an article that provides all the links, and so if you disbelieve, if you don't buy what I'm telling you, granted, that means you're probably not going to buy what the FBI is going to tell you either. But, I mean, all the information's there at middletheory.com. Take a look at that. We've got that article front and center up on the website and on the related podcast this past week. But, again, I say that, sure, there's the... And one of the listeners actually wrote in. We'll talk more about that on the Middle Theory show. But I do want to mention that one of the listeners actually wrote in and said, you know, great job that you guys did. And it's not a matter of debunking something. It's a matter of just saying, look, folks, the information is there. And I'm really ashamed that InfoWars wouldn't do a better job trying to find that information, let alone, and I'm sure we're not the only ones who knew where that relevant data was, but they didn't even try and look. They just want to promote this conspiracy.
Does it really surprise you, though?
No, it doesn't. But the thing is that those children, God, you know, I almost get emotional. I can't say too much about it here because I'll tell you, you know, the horror. I remember watching that as it unfolded that day. Many of us did, you know. And to try and say that it never happened and that there were no lives lost, you know. And it makes people angry when I try and say, yeah, folks, the information's out there. It did. But one of our listeners did write in, and he said that one interesting thing is, and I don't remember the guy's name. Maybe I could actually pull it up here, the email, but One of the parents that had appeared on camera, this fella said, I'm a drama major and also have worked in as an editor in films and whatnot. And he says that I recognized what the man seemed to be doing in this piece of footage as being a breathing exercise, which he says I've often seen actors do right before they end up going on camera. And he said, I'd actually been editing a film where just prior to the actual take, one of the female actresses had been doing this breathing exercise. And he said, I edited that into part of this segment of footage that I was doing to actually enhance the sense of urgency and her angst and basically conveying her emotion on camera by adding this sequence of her actually just warming up with this breathing exercise. He said the particular footage, and I'm sure that people listening probably remember what I'm talking about. You may have seen it. This guy, he's kind of chuckling and said, are we ready to do this? And he starts doing this breathing exercise very quickly. And then he goes on the mic and his whole demeanor changes. So people have raised questions about that. Yeah, I admit that even looks fishy to me. But with direct regard to the FBI not reporting deaths at Newtown, that's absolutely false. And at MiddleTheory.com, we've got the right information. I cannot believe. I know I shouldn't be surprised, but I really cannot believe that InfoWars would carry that story.
And because you've got all these people way too concerned about truth and not concerned about facts.
I know, right. Well, that's just it, And that's the thing is that sometimes, when it comes to digging into these conspiracies and to digging into the world of the unexplained, and everything that you read in the mainstream media is not always. I tell you, it is incredibly controlled. There is an element of control that most of us do not even. We do not appreciate the profundity of the control in media in the West. And it's not just here. Some of it is driven by bias, political or otherwise. A lot of it is driven by status quo. There have been famous commentators who've gone on the record and said that, listen, if you're a big name in media, you're in direct contact with and you're under essentially the watchful eye of agencies the likes of the CIA. Yes, media has been used to perpetrate, crap in the past that has been utilized for purposes of, psychological warfare here and also maintaining and controlling certain ideas as they may, arise in other nations, abroad. The UFO phenomena fits into that pretty well. And yes, media control, disinformation, all these things, they are very legitimate. But, again, the only issue I've ever had with the InfoWars crowd and with Alex Jones, I like Alex Jones, in general, and I think he's a good guy. I've said this before. A lot of his listeners who have come to this program and have heard what they take is me being overtly critical of him, or they don't like the impersonations of Alex that I've done in the past. And that's all just tongue-in-cheek. That's all for fun. But they get angry because they feel that if I don't say the same things that he does about, the coming police state, about, the Illuminati, about, the global agenda, and the fact that they think that they're in touch with aliens and that they think that they're better than us and that they're literally going to, they're going to adopt the transhumanist agenda. Any number of things that, Alex has said over the years. I agree with some of it. A lot of it I don't. But, when you're going to say, okay, look, here's the proof, folks, zero deaths at Newtown. And in fact, they just didn't do a good enough job looking for the information. That's what I take issue with. I don't take issue with people's, I can take issue with people's politics or whatever, but, being a middle of the road kind of guy myself. But, the big issue is when you present information, whether or not intended, as misleading information, and you use that to cater to an audience that already is part of a belief-oriented ideology. And we can see that in the UFO community. We can see that in the conspiracy community. We can see that in politics. It's all over the place. You have to doubt everything that you hear, but you have to doubt everything that you hear with a with a level of care rather than purely with just a bias toward, or rather a conviction to hear what you want to hear and only what confirms your predisposed beliefs.
And that comes back to what I was telling you earlier before we went on air with the news story I saw last night regarding the doctor from Sierra Leone who had Ebola.
Yeah, what was the deal with that?
Well, it's been known this doctor from Sierra Leone who was working in Sierra Leone contracted Ebola and was being brought to the United States for treatment on purpose. Not as a conspiracy, not as a biological weapon, but on purpose to treat and possibly save this man's life.
Right.
He died. But the news story was, Ebola rocks the heartland.
Oh, I know.
and then the news story continues to, say the facts, but a headline like, Ebola rocks the heartland, granted, will get more people to stay tuned, but Jesus, man. It doesn't, though. Ebola's not rocking anything.
Oh, it's rocking your socks right now, Chris. I wish you guys could see the passion in this man's face as he's relating this. No, good example. A very good example. But anyway, sometimes, because it's entirely relevant to the way that we discuss information on this program, you do have to remind yourselves, question everything, even if that is at the fringe sites that you frequently visit. When we come back, I want to visit another idea, UFOs being made by Airbus, here on the Graylian Report. Stay with us. Dark and tonight very cold part of the Appalachian Mountains. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the one and only Graylian Report. We're having such a great time. Hope you are just as well. That was an extremely skeptical first segment. It really was, but I think that's necessary sometimes. Again, especially when we're talking about misremembering lives that have been tragically lost, it's important to adhere to at least certain facts, right? Yeah, but then again, I'm just trying to basically, you know, pander mysterious stuff to
people.
They don't
call me the armchair skeptic for nothing.
I'm the believer's skeptic. You're the armchair skeptic. Let's get our tobacco pipes out, old boy.
Molly!
You know, the beautiful thing about the cooler weather, and I do want to talk a little bit here about this, what they're referring to as a UFO patent that the Airbus company is apparently making headlines with regard to this announcement of this patent. Interesting stuff. I mean, we are looking at many, many, many changes in the way that we transport ourselves around the world. And, of course, aviation itself is changing. But first, I do want to mention that I've had a little bit of time since it's the cooler weather months and the band hasn't been out on the road traveling and performing. Oh, actually, we've been traveling an awful lot. We played twice on Saturday and, you know, had another gig Friday night. I mean, there's still a good bit of travel, but just not as much as the summertime is what I'm saying. And as the cold weather begins to sneak up on us, people in the chat room there at graylianreport.com/podcast and radio, they're asking if it's snowing outside. And again, I think it is, but you're the guy who was most recently on the elevator coming down. So while you were above ground, was it indeed snowing outside here in Asheville, Chris?
It was. Well, flurrying.
Flurrying, yeah. They are calling for some snow tomorrow. But well, anyway, when it gets cold and it starts, you know, getting weather to be, you know, holing up inside, whether you be in a cozy, warm cottage or maybe like me in a you know, fallout shelter underground, I love to be able to catch up on reading. And I was recently, here are a couple of the books I've been reading, Chris, these two right here. I wrote a review of this one. Are you familiar with this book right here, The Invisible College?
Is it by that Jax Valley guy?
Jax Valley, yeah.
Jax Valley?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's been re-released by Anomalist Books, and I wrote a review of this at Mysterious Universe because I was interested, and I actually told Patrick Weege at Anomalist, I said, you know, this is one of Valley's books that I actually have not read. Now, I found that a lot of the information is very similar to what he has written about in other books, but the idea with The Invisible College was that, you know, he was talking about sort of the collective efforts of a group of researchers who... and there's actually a photograph of them, you know, academicians and people who operate behind the scenes, but who nonetheless were very willing to, you know, engage in serious research with regard to UFOs. And, you know, this idea that nobody believes in UFOs or that nobody of credible, you know, anyone of any kind of credible merit academically and whatnot would put their name behind serious research in UFOs, that's not necessarily the case. And I've disagreed with things that Valet has said before. At one point, actually, in the book, you know, he kind of looks at Assyrian and also, you know, Phoenician and a number of different kinds of, you know, pendants and amulets and hieroglyphs and different kinds of things. And he certainly kind of asserts the same sort of a thing that ancient alien theorists would, which is that certain circular formations and the like might be interpreted as being something else other than merely a symbolological reference to a god, to a deity, to something else like that. For instance, he was fascinated with the way that circular forms continuously appear and often depicted with clawed feet as though to represent some sort of a flying object, presumably one that's circular, that would be capable of landing. And hence, the reason for the depiction with the clawed feet would be so that this thing, to indicate that it was something that could land on the ground, come from the sky, land, and head back into the clouds. Now, I don't know that it's entirely without merit, you know, that discussion. In fact, I don't think it's without merit. It's just that I always worry about interpretation of information, especially of the ancient world, through the modern lens of technology and our modern concept of things like space flight, space travel, and the like. But it's interesting because the very next day I was reading a different book, and what I have here is The Essential Jung, selected writings of course, the famous Carl Jung. And in his writings on psychology and psychoanalysis, I came upon a very similar reference to this same sort of an interpretation. Now, keeping in mind that, of course, Jung had also written about flying saucers. And as a matter of fact, I might just pull up a quick reference here because, I mean, it's so fascinating hearing his interpretation of what flying saucers were. And again, I find that it's not entirely different, in truth, from the attitude espoused by Jacques Vallée over the years. In that, Jacques Vallée would say, you know, I don't know that we can say that UFOs are necessarily, you know, ETs or extraterrestrials, but he says in the high strangeness cases where we seem to have reports that indicate something strange has happened, people have had a weird interaction with it, it may have changed their lives, he says there seems to be a control mechanism, and whatever it is that we are perceiving seems innately oriented with us and interested in, maybe even vested in, trying to change our lives and maybe even steer the way that humans on the whole tend to think. You find a lot of similarities in that perspective and what Jung wrote about flying saucers. And this passage that was from his essay, Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth of Things Seen in the Skies, which actually I own that entire thing self-published or published you know, unto itself as just a you know, short but nonetheless a book. But this relevant portion is interesting. And if you have never read this, it's worth hearing about. It is a difficult, or rather this is actually from a portion of that. It is difficult to form a correct estimate of the significance of contemporary events, and the danger that our judgment will remain caught in subjectivity is great. So I'm fully aware of the risk I'm taking, Jung saying this, in proposing to communicate my views concerning certain contemporary events. Now, you can probably kind of glean what contemporary events he may be referring to, which he says seem to me important to those who are patient enough to hear me. I refer to those reports reaching us from all corners of the earth, rumors of round objects that flash through the troposphere and stratosphere and go by the name of flying saucers, disks, and UFOs. He probably would have said UFOs, actually, as was popularly said at the time. Now, these rumors or the possible physical existence of such objects seem to me so significant that I feel myself compelled, as once before, when events of fateful consequence were brewing for Europe, to sound a note of warning, or warning, rather. He said, I know that just as before my voice is much too weak to reach the ear of the multitude, it is not presumption that drives me, but my conscience as a psychiatrist that bids me fulfill my duty and prepare those few who will hear me for coming events which are in accord with the end of an era. As we know from ancient Egyptian history, their manifestations of psychic changes which always appear at the end of one Platonic month and at the beginning of another. Apparently, they are changes in the constellation of psychic dominance, or of the archetypes, or gods, as they used to be called, which bring about or accompany long-lasting transformations of the collective psyche. This transformation started in the historical era and left its traces first in the passing of the eon of Taurus into that of Aries, and then of Aries into Pisces, whose beginning coincides with the rise of Christianity. We are now nearing that great change which may be expected when the spring point enters Aquarius. It would be frivolous of me to try to conceal from the reader that such reflections are not only exceedingly unpopular, but even come perilously close to those turbid fantasies which becloud the minds of world reformers and other interpreters of signs and portents. But I must take this risk, Jung wrote, even if it means putting my hard-won reputation for truthfulness, reliability, and capacity for scientific judgment in jeopardy. I can assure my readers that I do not do this with a light heart. I am, to be quite frank, concerned for all those who are caught unprepared by the events in question and disconcerted by their incomprehensible nature. Since so far, as I know, no one has yet felt moved to examine and set forth the possible psychic consequences of this foreseeable astrological change, I deem it my duty to do what I can in this respect. I undertake this thankless task in the expectation that my chisel will make no impression on the hard stone it encounters. Now, that's a very interesting, introspective, even at times slightly eschatological statement to be made on a subject like UFOs. And a lot of people have criticized Jung for saying that essentially, well, UFOs are all just something that is, you know, stemming from within the mind. It's all interpretation of things yet to come. And these archetypal interpretations or visions that people have, they misinterpret as some sort of a physical something happening in the world. Whereas I don't know that that's necessarily what he felt. And in fact, Jung actually had said that he believed that there were, and there had actually been good evidence for, you know, example, I think that the radar trace evidence that had been collected by the U.S. Air Force and other agencies reported in Project Blue Book did seem to indicate that there was a physical phenomena at times, and Jung acknowledged that. But, you know, as he was mentioning, you know, what had been leading up prior to what occurred in Europe, of course, he had been talking about the world wars. And Jung said something very interesting about visions that he had had leading up to the First World War. And again, I don't think that he necessarily interpreted this as, I am a psychic and I am seeing visions and I can predict the future. You know, Jung felt that this collective unconscious, you know, was something that basically could kind of communicate with us. I mean, it gets much more deep than that, but the idea of the archetypes that he came to understand, he began to feel that, again, that there was a unique relationship with, you know, our conscious selves and then this underlying mind and the symbolic representations that often come forth in visions and dreams and things like that, and how we can learn to interpret things about not only ourselves, but maybe even external things happening in the world through the recognition of that, what you might call archetypal, underlying archetypal reality. Jung, prior to the First World War, had a vision that I think had accosted him, you might say, for a number of weeks, maybe months, and he had seen this very, I mean, it was like the end of the world kind of a thing with this huge flood. And he said that in the vision, he would see all of Europe being destroyed, but of course that the flood waters carrying essentially the demise of civilization would always stop as they got toward the Swiss Alps. And interestingly, he interpreted this as being evidence of, but before it actually outbroke, the First World War. And it's interesting, of course, to note that as we're talking about, you know, the Swiss Alps protecting, I guess, maybe we might say Scandinavia, you know, this comes back around to something I talk about in the Ghost Rockets. The Scandinavian countries being neutral throughout the conflict represent a very interesting locality during the Second World War, in that what we're talking about there is a group of countries that had not been directly involved in the conflict, you know, that had not directly been supporters. They certainly had economic agreements with, for instance, Germany. But it's these neutral countries in Scandinavia that later were, of course, the epicenter of the Ghost Rocket reports following the war. Very interesting that this sort of thing would be happening rather than being over the Allied countries or, you know, of course, you know, Russia or other parts of, again, Europe that had actually been part of the Axis forces, Italy or Germany. It's interesting that over these Scandinavian countries is where we see the bulk of the reports of the ghost rockets that began to occur. But anyway, Jung, I don't know how you could look at that outside the context of being representative of a kind of a premonition that he had had. It's just that I think that the way he interpreted these premonitions was very different, and he seemed to feel that the UFO phenomena was representative of some great change that was you know, ahead of us as humans, and that some of the high strangest, not maybe reports of, like, you know, things, oh, that's a UFO, when in fact it's quite obviously like a government aircraft or something. I mean, he's talking about strange lights that are seen in the sky, the very same sorts of things that Vallée talked about, in the sense that many people have interpreted these things, lights and, you know, disembodied voices, high strangeness reports that fall under the kind of loose categorization of being UFOs, but which Vallée would say are more evidence of a strange kind of transdimensional control system. Well, Jung would look at it a little differently, and he would have said, this is something that is communicating to humans, maybe from within ourselves, but evidence of something yet to come. And it was an interesting interpretation of the UFO phenomenon. I think that there's some pretty common ground between those two men, Vallée and Jung, But it is interesting to look at those two perspectives. You know, one that, again, many people mischaracterize as, oh, he just thought that we were all just, you know, making this up. I don't think that Jung thought that we were making up flying saucers. And the evidence for that is the fact that he took the time to write about them. He didn't try to just debunk the whole thing. He had a pretty far-out interpretation of what they might be. But again, I have always said that I think that there are a variety of things at play here. And, of course, the circular shape. That was something that was so often described by Jung and something that was kind of a focus of his writing. Valle, of course, talks about this also in the prominence of the circle and the circular objects seen in the skies that appear even in the ancient glyphs and the like of yesteryear. But this is interesting because bringing it back to the present day, there's a very interesting 360-degree design for a cabin on board an aircraft that has been making news, and the Business Insider, among other agencies, carried this today. Now, the patent application from France-based Airbus, SAS, an aircraft manufacturing division of the Airbus Group, was published last month, according to the Financial Times. It shows an elaborate design with a circular passenger cabin tucked behind the plane's nose and between its wings. I'm looking at the blueprints here. This thing looks an awful lot like kind of like your classic, you know, swept wing designed aircraft. There appears to be a fuselage, but then the seating is oriented in a circular, you know, fashion, as though you were like, if you've seen an amphitheater where people all gather around and then the performers are in the center at the base, that's what this this interior seating design kind of looks like. And that's been drawn up by listed investors or inventors Patrick Levin and Romain Delahaye, as reported by the Business Insider, as well as Caitlin Perjou, who proposed an aircraft with a cabin that extends over 360 degrees around a space-defined outside structure. The shape tackles a problem in the airline industry, which is essentially this. Cylindrical shapes are better at dealing with pressurized cabins, but at the front and back of these structures, there needs to be strong reinforcements to counter stresses. The circle shape, they say, alleviates this issue. The purpose of the invention is particularly to provide a simple, economic, and efficient solution to these problems. But let's think for just a minute, because they actually say a little later in the article, although it's patented the UFO-like design this year, it probably won't be put into motion anytime soon. Now, granted, we may be a little ways away from being able to put this in motion, but the point I'm making here is that they compare it already to being like a UFO. At very least, it's a lot like some sort of a starship is what it looks like. But interesting that they point out that by maintaining a circular structure, that this thing is capable of alleviating the counter stresses at the opposite ends of a cylindrical shape along the lines of a typical passenger jet. Now, when we look at certain UFO reports, I happen to know that he may still be in the chat room, and at least a while back, Mike Reese, yep, there he is, he's still there in the chat room. You know, I talk about the encounter that Mike had in 1973 in my book, The UFO Singularity, and Mike and I traveled down together to Locust Grove, where he said he saw a disc-shaped object with a circular kind of a, I mean, it was obviously shaped like a flying disc, a flying saucer. And that he got the impression that there was this centrifuge, and then there was a portion of the craft that was rotating, and that there were lights around the exterior of that. But let's just speculate for a moment. Whoever may be behind the design of what are literally described as resembling flying saucers, what if they are already hip to this idea? Somebody who had been building these things, something, if they come from elsewhere, if they come from beyond, who knows? But again, it's interesting that this new design, not only being circular and thus being reminiscent of course, the archetypal imagery that Jung associated with UFOs, but also that in terms of practical function, that this actually helps reduce counter stresses. And it's essentially is in the future, once a craft like this can be built, it will actually perhaps be a more both economical and also a slightly more eventually safe way to fly. And I'll point out one other thing, too, is that, you know, based on the seat structure, you know, another problem that you have when you're flying on an airplane, and this is purely from the sense of, you know, being a person who from time to time might enjoy a cocktail while he's flying. If you're on a long, cylindrical, seating arrangement like that, you know, they have to, of course, people who are bringing along the refreshments have to either start at one side or the other. And so if you're sitting in the middle, you got to wait all day before you can get your Coke or your coffee or your, you know, if you're going to have a cocktail, maybe a gin and tonic. But with this cylindrical kind of a setup, they don't have a narrow path of travel. You'll be able to presumably get to an exit more quickly. Or if you're, of course, if it's not an emergency concern that would require getting to an exit, you may be able to get to a restroom, or you may actually be able to be served a little more quickly. So in addition to the practical structural considerations, it's interesting because this quote-unquote 360-degree UFO-shaped plane that Airbus wants to build, this thing actually, well, very well might improve comfort in a lot of ways just as well. Kind of interesting. I'd fly on one, and plus, come on, flying in this great big round room where everybody's seated facing one another, that'd just be kind of cool. But everybody goes to sleep on these planes anyway, not like they're really going to be looking at you. We'll pick up with a few more of the latest news stories on the other side of this break here on the Gray Alien Report. Stay with us. Mountains of Appalachia. It is the Gray Alien Report. I'm Micah Hanks. Welcome back. I'm cracking up over here, Chris, because as we're doing this, I'm seeing, you first pointed it out, we were talking about this revolutionary new aircraft that the Airbus company is seeking to design. And lo and behold, you're talking about an airplane flying through the chat room there at GrayAlienReport.com. And I said, I didn't do that. How are they doing that? And then there was a UFO, and I look over just in time. You know, I've been waiting my entire life. This is interesting cultural commentary. Every time I look up, I see, you know, a plane. Somebody else says it was a UFO, and I clearly see a plane. Well, this time, somebody says they see a plane, and I look just in time to see a UFO. Race, are you over there? He's over there clowning around, isn't he?
Oh, yes, I'm here.
There he is. Finally, the Graylian audiences get to enjoy that deep baritone of yours. What are you doing over there? How are you doing this, in fact? That's the question I have.
Well, that's just part of the magic of live and interactive chat, Brother Micah.
Yes, it is. You literally are flying Graylian spaceships through our chat room there.
Yeah, it's those are kind of cool. Those Exat that we have our chat rooms from, they provide those for us, and they're really cool. People seem to like them.
That's hilarious. Yeah, and I see somebody, ex-lady there in the chat room saying, Micah, I want you to know the first time that happened, I thought it was a virus. No, folks, no. No Ebola outbreaks in the Graylian chat room. And by the way, I just want to thank you, Ray, since we got you on here. Graylian listeners don't generally get to hear your voice. This is our producer back at Master Control in Fort Smith, Arkansas, at the helm of the KGRA radio network. And, you know, the chat room is working extraordinarily well. The stream, of course, is so much more reliable, and people who do tune in and listen live, they're having a great time. It's really, really enhanced this listening experience, and I just want to thank you right here on the program for all the work that you're doing behind the scenes, brother. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Micah. It's a pleasure, and, you know, working with you and Chris and the Graylian gang, the Graylianites, has been it's a dream come true for me, Micah, honestly.
It's a good time. It's kind of meant to be, in fact, I think. And so, yeah, we're gonna look forward to more ways that we can kind of combine our efforts and have a lot of fun. So, anyway, Race, we appreciate you, buddy. And I guess on to the news here. What was it we were looking at here? There was one more story I did want to talk about here a little bit, Chris, before we go to the top of the hour. And that was the fact that a convicted terrorist described as the 20th hijacker, and that's, yes, in relation to 9/11, well, he has made a very stunning claim about the 9/11 attacks. And this is what he has actually said. He has claimed that a Saudi Arabian royal had helped fund the devastating terror events that occurred on September 11th, 2001. Now, Zacharias Moussaoui, Age 46 has said more specifically that a Saudi prince had paid to train him and the 19 hijackers in the time leading up to the attacks. He issued these allegations and recently filed federal court documents alleging that the prince was fully aware that the training was being done on behalf of Osama bin Laden. I'm ready to testify about all of the above and more in your court in an open hearing that I request, he has said. Now, there have been some people who have doubted this fellow. Okay, Musaw, he had actually been originally arrested, I think, back in August of 2001, just 1 month before 9/11. I think that the story had been that staffers at a Minnesota flight school became concerned over his quest to learn to fly a Boeing 747. Despite not having a pilot's license, they were concerned that there might be something up. Now this, yeah, right. Boy, if only that information had been used, well, about a month after the fact. But they also point out that he may have been a slightly unreliable individual with regard to the testimony he's given at times. And as a matter of fact, they state in the Blaze carried the story saying that, quote, his credibility is at issue in taking his claims at face value, especially considering that a defense psychologist once said that he actually suffers from delusions as a result of paranoid schizophrenia. Get this. But here's what's interesting. The fact that he asserts that there is a Saudi Arabian royal that was related to this is actually consistent with something we've talked about on this show in the past. Chris, do you remember the story, the 7,200-word redaction from the congressional inquiry into the cause of 9/11?
Vaguely.
Well, here's the story. You know, again, this information was actually redacted, but there are members of Congress who can actually access the entire thing and have actually done so, and that in reading this full report, not the public version that includes the 7,200-word redaction, they can't say exactly what happens, but there have been people on record, congressmen, who have actually said it's information that would cause us to have to rethink everything we think we know about 9/11. It would be embarrassing. It wouldn't break our country apart, but it would certainly be embarrassing in relation to what we think we know and the official cause of what actually happened that day. And I suppose that that probably would have to do with breakdowns in intelligence, that if heeded, if warnings had been heeded a little as he scratches his large red beard. Sorry, I just love that.
Sometimes bears got to scratch.
Yes, indeed. But no, the idea here is that it has been inferred that this 7,200-word redaction actually contains information that does implicate the Saudis with 9/11. I have said in the past, and I'll say again here, that it sounds to me an awful lot like a credible different take, nonetheless, but a very credible one, that has to do with this idea of there being a conspiracy. A cover-up, a 9/11 cover-up, and I don't think that the cover-up is that it was an inside job and that there were people who were rigging the building with explosives, but there's definitely information that has been withheld from the public. And sadly, what this man has said, whether or not people choose to consider him a reliable, you know, source on this kind of information, it nonetheless is in keeping with what people have inferred this document actually contains, that there was a Saudi connection, and there have been a lot of people who have said that, which in itself, to me, is an extremely disturbing component to this. And I find time and time again, Chris, that when our government lies to us and they hide information from the public, it less often has to do, excuse me, it less often has to do with information. See, they're trying to choke me right now. I'm about to tell the truth, and they're trying to literally keep me from talking on the microphone.
Who, the Saudis or our government?
Our government.
Okay.
When they are engaged in a cover-up, I tend to find that it is more often aimed at trying to save face and cover mistakes that have occurred rather than something aimed entirely at, well, you know, just dissuading the public from believing in conspiracies and the fact that they were doing things that they shouldn't have been doing, i.e. false flags and the like. I'm a little wary of all that. But anyway, when we come back, we'll delve into one of the biggest cover-ups many have alleged, and that is the UFO connection to ETs here on the Graylian Report.
This is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And when I said it was cold in Appalachia tonight, I wasn't kidding, was I, Chris Hayes, as you freeze over there?
I'm my teeth are chattering right now.
Tough it out, guy.
I will. My face is warm. My chin is the warmest it's ever been.
Yes, exactly. As we're engaging in a fair share of chin wagging here tonight on the program, we're about to get into a bit about alien contact here on Earth. And we've got a lot of different angles we're going to approach this from. And I do specifically want to discuss the Boyd Bushman thing. But first, I want to talk with you, Chris, about your ideas about alien life and whether we might have been visited. Before we get to that, however, I do want to also mention that if you are not already a subscriber of Grillion X, let me tell you a little bit about what you're missing. Not only do you get an additional weekly show, an additional update, an additional edition, in fact, that we call the Grillion X podcast, but we also feature from time to time other kinds of content. Once a month, you're also going to get Enigmas, which is a Grillion Report special series that looks at specific cases and does so in a slightly more theatrical way. There's music involved, you know, that really sets kind of an ominous tone. This month, this ended up being one of my favorite episodes, I have to say. We look at Spring-Heeled Jack. It's a story that, you know, I had followed quite a bit and I've always been interested in. But Spring-Heeled Jack, that story, again, it had a little to do with... Interesting, there were some political writers that were involved. Edmund Burke had actually written a number of at least a couple of entries, I think, on this subject, which we feature on the program. But what I did not know was that following the wave that initially began, I guess, in the 1830s, where people were describing variously what was described as a bear or something like a bear, some people were describing a ghost. There is a rich history of ghosts that were even at times maybe referred to as Steel Jack or similar names. And so many folklorists have said that the belief in the entity known as Spring-Heeled Jack had actually stemmed from these ghost stories in that area. But again, there are so many different interpretations of what was being seen. Again, there was something that was either bear or maybe monkey-like that was reported. One farmer had said that this thing leapt up on top of the wall that actually enclosed his garden, ran along the perimeter of the wall, and then down into the garden and chased him around his garden. And he's described it as being like a bear. But then again, what kind of a bear can crawl up a wall like that, run around? I mean, he seemed to indicate maybe that the thing had actually run on two legs.
That kind of sounds, you know, if you discount the human element, the way you describe that sounds a lot like Grendel from Beowulf.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I mean, maybe so. I mean, there's definitely a bit of a comparison that could be made to what was seen in 2000 in New Delhi, India, when, again, there was this what was called the Monkey Man was seen. But some of the descriptions of the Monkey Man, get this, were rather than being a monkey, it was some sort of an entity, a humanoid, that had a metal breastplate, like armor. It had claws, and this thing apparently had worn a helmet. And these are all features that were described in relation to Spring-Heeled Jack. But there were still reports of weird characters that were being seen as recently as 2012. And there was an incredibly compelling report I found. It didn't sound like Spring-Heeled Jack. I mean, it sounds like a humanoid, but you'll have to listen to this. It really blew my mind digging into this. And so Enigmas this month gets into some of these accounts. I tell you, there's a lot more to the history and a lot more to the folklore behind that story. And again, I think if I had to find a position on that, I would say it's probably still mostly folklore, but there's definitely a lot more going on behind the scenes there with that story than people realize. That is this month on Enigmas.
Well, I wonder with the mention of the Monkey Man in India, how closely related Chinese and Indian folkloric traditions are, because the way that was described and the behavior sounds a lot like the fabled Monkey King from the I guess the most famous story out of Chinese folklore, The Journey to the West.
Right. Yeah, you know, you'll find a lot of those parallels the more that you dig into this with time. And again, there's just a lot. You dig into this, and again, I think sometimes I come at it primarily when it comes to Fortiana. I think I come at it primarily as a folklorist, but, you know, you'll find some pretty bizarre, really, really, really strange tie-ins from time to time, and that's certainly what happened with Spring-Heeled Jack. So If you're a subscriber, you may have already heard this, and if not, you can find out more at graylinreport.com/X. It's just $7 a month, but we do offer $77 for a year. You get a full month free if you sign up for a year. Well worth the money. And just keep in mind, you go to fast food restaurants these days, you're going to spend more than that generally, even if you're ordering fast food. It's very hard to find a good lunch. And think of all the quality entertainment you get for literally less than what you're going to spend on a meal once a month. Graylin X.
But will Graylin X sustain me? Will it give me the satisfaction of having bitten into two well-beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed? I can't finish that for infringement rights.
You obviously don't know about the meat cube.
Oh.
But we'll have to talk about that some other time. Right now, I want to talk about aliens. Now, I'm not saying it's aliens, Chris, but I want to know, do you believe that aliens are visiting Earth? I think I might know the answer to this question, but I want to ask you anyway.
Gosh, it's so... There are a lot of facets to that question, really, for me.
Yeah?
I know you're expecting me to say, no. No, I don't. But, I mean, if there are other sentient beings, intelligent life in the universe, then I don't want to say no. I don't think it's very likely. But there is, like I said before, absolutely a non-zero chance that we have been visited. Now, do I think that we've got these hyper-intelligent visitors coming from outer space to perform archaic medical experiments on human beings that haven't been practiced since prior to them first being mentioned?
Yeah, like
absolutely not.
Yeah.
Like probes and things. We if you are intelligent enough to travel at sublight speeds or even faster than light speeds across the galaxy to visit another planet, you're not going to go sticking something up someone's bum to get information.
You think not?
I mean, unless that's their fetish, it makes no sense. It's inefficient. It does not in any way engender trust if gathering that information is a precursor to making contact.
Yeah. Now, I will say this. In my opinion, I think that Earth very well may have actually been visited. I really do. I think that humans have variously at times maybe been in touch with alien intelligence. Now, I think that the problem is that, you know, I draw a distinction between alien and what we would call extraterrestrial. And so I think that a lot of people look at this and they go, you know, you believe in aliens? Well, you know, again, what is an alien? I think that coming back to Vallée and his research, that alien might be the more appropriate term to use for all this rather than extraterrestrial, because extraterrestrial is a pretty clear reference to some sort of a technology, some sort of a, or rather I shouldn't say a technology, an intelligence that comes hailing from another world beyond planet Earth, but nonetheless interpreted as being something physical. Whereas, I would say that if we look at, you know, the idea that maybe people who have utilized ayahuasca and, you know, entheogens and things like this, could they have actually had, who knows, encounters with disembodied sentient intelligences? Now, let's say that if a ghost actually exists and someone claims that they've had an interaction with a ghost may be some sort of a remnant of the conscious, you know, the conscience of a, or rather the consciousness of a person. But that isn't necessarily a physical person. Now, that doesn't necessarily qualify as being an alien, but certainly a non-human interaction of sorts, right? So I think that there are a lot of different levels of contact that may have occurred between human beings and non-human beings. And again, when it comes to trying to define aspects of the maybe high strangeness component underlying UFOs, maybe, just maybe, we could say that there have been contacts that have occurred with alien intelligence. I don't know that extraterrestrial necessarily falls under that. But it's an interesting discussion to be had no matter how you want to look at it. And again, the question that has lingered for so long is, you know, are we in touch with aliens? Have we been in touch with aliens? Are aliens visiting Earth? And does UFO phenomenon actually represent that? Now, there have been a lot of claims along those lines in recent weeks, and probably the one that's gotten the most attention has been the Boyd Bushman affair. We have not talked about this on this program, and I just want to say that the primary reason why we have not is because, you know, I looked at this story and I see, you know, Boyd sitting there, again, purportedly a former Lockheed Martin senior scientist, And he's showing these photographs of what to me looked like an obviously fake alien in these pictures. You've seen the pictures, right, Chris?
Yes.
You know, I did not find them compelling. I did not look at these pictures and go, my God, there it is. There's the alien. There's the alien we've all been looking for. You know, I just am not overtly convinced that that's what this was. Now, I'll get around to that photograph here in a moment, because I think that there's more that can and should be and will be said about that. But, you know, I'd seen so many news agencies carrying this story. I think HuffPo obviously talked about it. RT, Russia Today, had actually carried it. And actually, just because since they wrote about this, again, there were numerous news agencies that carried this story. And they linked to the 30-minute video, which at least the version that I went looking for, I noticed, has been taken down. There had been a copyright claim made against that video, and it's actually been removed. But there's a 30-minute interview that had been, you know, billed as the deathbed confession of Boyd Bushman. And, you know, excerpting a little bit from the RT article, it's interesting because they wrote about it. They said the controversial 33-minute video was made shortly before Boyd Bushman died on August 7th, 2014. However, the footage has only recently emerged and is starting to garner widespread attention. Now, it had actually sat online for a few weeks before people started really getting hip to it. And then all of a sudden there was this kind of this overnight just explosion of interest in this video, in which Bushman says, "I do have a top secret clearance," which he affirms at the beginning of the video. And he goes on to state that incidents like what happened at famous Roswell, New Mexico in 1947 had actually happened, and that alien life had been involved. Now, Bushman shared details about aliens, UFOs, and anti-gravity technology in the video, which, again, I think that there are still versions of online, which he says is being developed, get this, by U.S., Russian, and Chinese scientists, and that they're all working together in collusion with one another at the secretive Area 51 facility at Groom Lake, Nevada. Now, Bushman also, again, has this photograph, and he describes the aliens, one of which he shows a picture of. He says they were approximately 4.5 to 5 feet tall. They actually have three backbones that are comprised of cartilage in their backs, and that they have fingers and toes just like humans just as well. They're able to use their own voice by telepathy to talk to you. In other words, you walk into a room with one, he says, and he said that you won't hear them talking, but you, if you have a question for them, for instance, will hear in your own voice, in your head, the answer being given to you as they communicate telepathically with you. Now, according to Bushman, there are two different groups of these aliens, which he calls them wranglers and the others rustlers. He says it's like a cattle ranch. One group is wranglers, the other are rustlers, the stealers of cattle. Wranglers are much more friendly and have a better relationship with humans. But then, of course, he says that they're the rustlers. He claims that these creatures are inhabitants of a planet called Quintumnia. It's located 68 light years away from Earth, and yet it takes them only 45 minutes to travel to our planet. While they're at home, they communicate exclusively using this telepathic means of communication that we've discussed already. Now, Bushman had gone on to say that he said he had never, or rather that he had seen their homes because he had actually given the aliens a camera to take pictures with, which they apparently took photos and then brought back to him.
Were there any selfies?
Alien? Well, presumably that's an alien selfie that he's seen holding up in the video, yeah.
Click.
Now, what's funny about this is that apparently, I think it was TVQC in Quebec, Canada, who had found that this alien, or something that looks damn similar to the alien in the photograph that Bushman holds up during this video, can actually be purchased at Walmart. Now, here's the thing. He says that he had purportedly given them a camera, and that they had apparently taken alien selfies and, you know, pictures of their home and everything. And this is the picture. If he knew what these aliens looked like, he, of course, has this picture, and hence he should have known that this picture depicted one of the aliens that he had purportedly had these interactions with. And yet the picture actually only shows a mummy, or rather, that's a reference, by the way, to the alien mummy of the Linville Gorge, the alien Muppet, as we sometimes call it. But this is basically a little stuffed alien doll that you can buy at Walmart. And our friend Marilyn Carlson, actually, who supplied me with that Bigfoot plaster casting in Studio C down the hall there, Marilyn actually sent me a picture today. She has one of the things, and she actually sent me a picture of the little alien posing on her couch with the bottle of beer. Much better picture than the one Bushman had. So, I mean, if people are in contact with aliens, I mean, hell, at least give them a beer, right? But thank you, Marilyn, by the way, for sending that photo along. Yes, this is quite obviously a dummy that can be bought, a little toy, a stuffed alien, a Graylian, if you want to call it that, that you can buy at Walmart. Now, this brings a number of questions to mind, and this is, you can kind of see part of why I didn't want to talk about this. It's not because I didn't put much stock in it. It's because, you know, Boyd has just passed away. And I think that there are a couple of troubling questions about this. First of all, I wouldn't call this video a deathbed confession. It was a video that was an interview that was released, I guess, shortly after his death. But it wasn't him lying in a hospital bed in his final moments. They're calling it a deathbed confession. It seems that's a much more sensational way to build this story. But really, it was a video that he had done. Maybe he had sensed that the end was near and that he felt it was, you know, appropriate to go and talk about all this. But the thing is that, again, was he being pranked by somebody, or was he complicit with what is apparently obviously a hoax? Some people have even likened this to being another MJ-12 in the sense that they feel that poor Boyd, maybe in his later years, was gullible enough not to fact-check and cross-reference the information that someone else gave to him, and that maybe he was not the source of the hoax, but that nonetheless a hoax ensued. It seems pretty clear that that's the case here. But, and you know, again, a lot of these claims, you know, the telepathic aliens and all this stuff, you know, the good guys and the bad guys, the reference to, you know, cattle wrangling, whether or not that's an indirect reference to cattle mutilations or not. A lot of this stuff has already been present for decades in the UFO literature. It's nothing that we haven't heard already. And the evidence that's been presented in defense of that idea or these sets of ideas now is far from convincing. But Snopes.com, you know, they ask some even deeper questions, and I have an excerpt from the Snopes entry about this, where they talk about this, and one of the first questions that they actually ask about this is really whether this is indeed, whether it can be confirmed who Boyd Bushman is, you know, whether that's indeed him in the video. I think that probably there are people in the UFO community who knew him, and that can be confirmed, but, you know, is there any way to vouch for his actual background with Lockheed? The man who appeared, and this is what it says, the man who appeared in the video hasn't been positively identified as a former Lockheed Martin engineer named Boyd Bushman. But even if the fellow is who he claims to be and he genuinely believed the images displayed in the video were of a real alien, evidence points to someone else's possibly doing the hoaxing. So what happened here? Was he given disinformation that he simply, sadly, was gullible enough to accept at face value? Was he complicit with the dissemination of this information himself? It's a weird, weird story. But, I mean, again, the thing in the photograph didn't even look convincing, let alone the fact that now everybody who's gone to Walmart and bought one's posting their pictures of Boyd Bushman's alien online. You know, it's really more sad than anything, I think.
I don't know. I mean, and this is coming just straight from my own ideals and how far I'd be willing to push the envelope. But if you're going to do a deathbed troll, I think it would be better than this one. Like, I don't think this is a last-ditch effort to prank the world by, if he is a Lockheed Martin employee, an incredibly smart man.
He'd had to have been an intelligent individual. You know, again, there's so many aspects of this story that don't seem to really add up. What was going on here? You know, maybe we're reading too much into it. But again, this is why I chose not to talk about it for a while, and people have kept sending this story in the last few days. Adam Loyle had actually linked to the Snopes article. And, you know, again, there have been many people. As a matter of fact, RT, at the very bottom of their report on this story, they didn't entirely present this as though it were credible information. I think they kind of take a slightly snarky attitude throughout the entire thing, as most agencies would, and that's expected. But the last line, they say, however, the alien seen in Bushman's photographs is actually available to buy at Walmart, according to an investigation by TVQC in Canada. So, I mean, that's been reported really across the board by a number of these news agencies. That's well known at this point. And again, it's like, you know, how did you not know? Now, with regard to this UFO photograph, I'm sorry, you had another point to make, but then we'll get to this other UFO photograph.
Nope, I was going to make a joke.
Go ahead and make a joke.
Well, it was a canalian. Of course it looked weird.
Canalian, there you go. nothing to be misconstrued as or mistaken for a cannolian, which is a variety of a pastry from outer space. But that was really lame. I'm just going to stop trying to tell jokes. I think I just broke the internet. Kim Kardashian, keep trying, darling. We already done it.
We broke it with shame.
Yeah, with shameful jokes. Okay. There's another, actually, you know, we're actually coming up on a break, so really we'll have to save this for when we come back. But there is, in wake of the whole Bushman fiasco, another alleged alien photograph. I mistakenly said a UFO photograph yesterday. Well, we see those all the time. I'm still waiting for a really, really, really good one, although I have actually seen a few good ones. We've got a few at GrayleonReport.com that I find more than convincing. But will we be convinced by this latest claim from a Roswell UFO researcher who says he's got photographic proof of an alien from 1947? Heard a legend some time ago, Chris, that there was indeed a photograph of an alien that had surfaced. And I think that this had been written about in a blog post probably by Anthony Bregaglia. But there was no photograph. I mean, there was mention of the photograph.
Yeah.
But there was no photograph. And I was always a little disappointed. I mean, hey, if you guys have got a photograph, why haven't we seen it?
I don't think you can handle it.
Yeah, you can't handle the truth,
can you? Your tiny little brain would break.
Yeah, we would break not only the internet with a celebrity butt shot, but we would also break our brains with the realization of there being an extraterrestrial presence in our midst. But, no, this is an actual claim. And
I'd even go a little conspiracy theorist on this one. Like,
okay, good. Let's do this. Go.
Imagine. Okay. So there is irrefutable photographic evidence of a living organism, sentient or otherwise, from another planet that has come to Earth.
Yeah.
If that's made public, what do you think? What kind of storm do you think that would cause among 90% of the world's populace? Something proved, or proven rather, that flies directly in the face of thousands of years of deeply held beliefs.
Yeah, religion. I mean, science, really, too. I mean,
yeah, it would be absolute chaos.
It probably would be. You know, I got to tell you, we're going to have the folks from the Sasquatch Chronicles podcast on this show, and I want to do that because I was on their program the other day with Wes and Shannon. Shannon and I have been in touch for a long time, and she had always wanted to get me on the program. And talking with the two of them, you know, they do a great show, and And Wes was asking me, interestingly, about whether there was a Bigfoot cover-up. And I said, well, I mean, I certainly... And I had to try and paraphrase this by talking about the belief in there being a UFO cover-up. But I am a little less convinced that there is a UFO cover-up and that information is being withheld from the public. And kind of in the line of thought that Colonel John Alexander has espoused in his book and also his, you know, public discourse on this subject, there doesn't seem to be a lot of credible evidence that we, as historians or as researchers, you know, can rely on. And again, I think that's the important point to be made, because a lot of people would probably listen to a discussion like this and say, oh, Mike is so skeptical tonight. God, why is he such a skeptic? Being skeptical is about being able to have reliable information that supports the argument that you're trying to pose. And you have to understand where I'm coming from. I am a writer, and I personally will be criticized if what I write is not capable of being backed by factual evidence. You know, for instance, I actually saw a thread going on Twitter last night about two of my books, The UFO Singularity and Ghost Rockets. And the UFO Singularity was the major, you know, mass market publication. You know, we produced Ghost Rockets and published that here in-house with Rocketeer Press, our own little imprint. But 10 to 1 people prefer the Ghost Rockets book. And I what I really love about the UFO Singularity is the fact that that book looks at the UFO phenomena and some of the memes, I think, present in this field through the lens of future technology and the expectations of our modern futurologists. I find that fascinating. But, you know, one of the tweeters had said, you know, that book, you know, didn't lead me to any conclusions that I personally haven't already drawn, whereas the Ghost Rockets is based on, you know, factual data, a lot of information, reports that can be, you know, fact-checked and validated, and information that's actually stored at NASA's Aviation Safety Reporting Center. In other words, there's a lot of data. And people on the thread were all of them virtually saying, oh, the Ghost Rockets, you know, that book, you know, never would have thought that that book would have become what it has. And again, it kind of shows that in the UFO community, we can speculate all day, and I state in the UFO Singularity that there's a good bit of speculation in that book. Now, I try to back it all up with a lot of information that comes from science journals, technology reviews, you know, and these sorts of things, too, in relation to the discussion that we have in that book, and it is more of a thought experiment. But if you're a UFO researcher, you know, you get to a point where, you know, you can only speculate so much, and you do have to present facts. And more as a researcher, that's kind of the direction I've gone, which is why the Ghost Rockets, being a book that followed the UFO Singularity, took more of that kind of an approach to it. So when I'm being skeptical, folks at home, you do have to remember the reason why, as a writer and a researcher and someone who wants to be able to use historical data, government data, or any other kind of data to substantiate the argument being made, the reason and the necessary reason that skepticism is employed in making that argument. I maintain that there is a phenomena, and that collectively we could say that UFO phenomena seems to occur, and that there is documented evidence that UFO phenomena has been occurring at least for the better part of the last half century, probably more, according to certain theorists, the likes of Jacques Vallée and others. But again, you know, what you can't prove is, you know, what the source of this phenomena is, you know, what the modus operandi of it is, if it is indeed intelligently controlled, which is essentially the assertion of the ET hypothesis people. And people who are of this mind tend to say that the Space Brothers have been coming here. You know, they are coming here to protect us from ourselves. Chris, you remember we had Robert Hastings on the show a while back?
Oh, yeah.
And Robert, I like Robert a lot, and, you know, wonderful guy, brilliant thinker. But, you know, when we had him on the show, we did disagree. And I even told him, we agreed to disagree. And it wasn't, a falling out kind of a thing. I mean, you know, it was very respectful. But he had said, if aliens are coming to Earth, i.e. extraterrestrials, and they are dismantling our nuclear sites, not really like taking them apart, but taking them down temporarily, as has been reported in his book, UFOs and Nukes, he says, then all the better, because essentially they're protecting us from doing things that could be harmful to us here on the whole. And I think that a lot of people look at UFOs as being representative of the alien overlords that are coming to protect us from ourselves, which removes, in the minds of some, I guess, the necessity for accountability that we as humans culturally, politically, and otherwise, are supposed to have. But if we can't govern ourselves and prevent catastrophic, you know, global change that usually results as a product of, you know, conflict and war, if we can't govern ourselves any better than to prevent the outbreak of war and to prevent the horrors of genocide and holocausts as have happened, and, you know, hopefully we can prevent from happening as we steadily careen toward, you know, being more civilized on the whole as a civilization, you know, I think that it's up to us as humans to be able to do that. And I fear sometimes that the belief in an extraterrestrial component to the UFOs, whether or not there is one, there could be, but the belief in it, despite the possibilities or what the evidence actually entails, often is actually utilized as some sort of a strange kind of an escape mechanism where people don't have to maintain that accountability for themselves because the aliens are going to do it for us. And hence we come back to this argument that had been brought. Where's Micah Hanks been for the last 60 years? You know, well, first of all, I mean, I was born in 1983. I'm aging myself, dating myself here. Is that legal in this state, by the way, to date myself?
I don't know. I think we're real close. We're working on legislation.
Okay. Yeah.
But pretty soon you will be able to date yourself. It's all about legalizing cloning. See? We gotta start at the small stuff.
Yeah, sorry. I if I met a clone of myself, I would have to say you're not my type.
Yeah, no, I would tell myself to kick rocks any day.
I prefer the girls. I just got to be honest. You know, Micah, you're an attractive guy, but
ooh, can you imagine a female me?
Could you imagine a female me? Gosh, I mean,
yeah, I can.
She would never stop talking.
Amy Pond.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you could be a companion.
I have a companion.
Well, I mean, well, since
I just got downgraded.
Since you lack the required plumbing to be a companion, you are by default a doctor.
I guess so. Okay. Well, Chris, in here you were worried about being a comic relief. He makes me laugh.
Wait, I'm sciencing here. What are you talking about?
No, here's the science. Again, I want to come back around to the idea of there being photos of aliens, okay? If we were to say that we had hard proof of aliens, then I would be persuaded to say, okay, this is more than just a myth surrounding, I think, what a lot of people want to be, belief that our alien overlords are here to protect us from ourselves. But have we had a good photograph that's been produced yet, you know? I have not seen a compelling photograph. And in fact, I've got a whole book about, you know, Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind in here. Actually, I've got a lot of books that deal with, you know, the idea of alien contact. Very few of the books present to me information that is credible and you know, quantifiable on par with the UFO reports themselves that substantiate an alien presence. Now, there are some reports of entities. Again, I think that one of the most compelling of all time to me, and one that has always stood out in my mind, was the story of the Pascagoula abduction, you know, Calvin Parker and Charles Hickson, and what they described came off of what was clearly an egg-shaped UFO. They described this strange interaction with this whatever this thing was, and these entities that came off of it. There are from time to time pretty compelling reports that involve beings on these craft, and I don't want to, you know, discount that. But while there are at very least some compelling photos of UFOs, there are very few compelling photos of aliens. And what Boyd Bushman held up that I think is beyond a shadow of a doubt been proven to be a hoax, I mean, that didn't do it for me. So what does? Now, Tom Carey's a guy that we had on the program a while back. And he and, of course, Don Schmidt, they wrote the book that's we actually interviewed them on this show about that. And it was Behind the Real Area 51, I believe. But they've also, of course, done a number of other books that have to do with Roswell. That's primarily what they've done. Now, Tom had apparently been part of a panel discussion, I believe, at American University, where he had, I think that some of the other participants had been Leslie Kane. We had, I know Leslie Kane was on there. I'm trying to remember who all else. Anyway, well, the point is that he was on this panel, and he apparently made the claim that he had this photograph that he says will prove once and for all that aliens are real. Now, I'd heard about this again in relation to some of the blogging that had been put out by the Roswell Dream Team. I think Anthony Bregaglia wrote about it at the UFO Iconoclasts. Here's what Alejandro Rojas actually has had to say about this as far as what he reported at Open Minds recently. He said, Carey has been researching the alleged crash of a flying saucer in Roswell, New Mexico since 1991. Now, he is the co-author and researcher, as I just stated, of a couple of books on this topic with Don Schmidt. And he told the crowd there at American University that he has images that are on Kodachrome color slides, and that their research on the legitimacy of the slides has been very promising. Here's what he said specifically, Tom Carey. He says, what's interesting is the film is dated to 1947, which coincides with the year of the Roswell crash. He said, we took it to the official historian of Kodak up in Rochester, New York. Listeners of KGRA will probably remember that Richard Dolan always says that his hometown Rochester is famous for, you know, the Kodak factory. Well, that's what Tom Carey did. They took it there to the official historian of Kodak, who did his due diligence on it, according to Carey. And he said, yes, this film strip, the slides that the photographs were taking on are from 1947. It's 1947 stock, and from the emulsions on the image, it's not something that's been photoshopped like today. He says it's original 1947 images, and it shows an alien who's been partially dissected lying in a case. Oh, I'm sorry, were you going to jump in and say something?
Only about the fact that it's on Kodachrome film. This is just from my photography days. Yeah. The fact that it's on a Kodachrome film or any kind of chrome film from Kodak, mm-hmm, is I can't believe I'm about to say this.
Go ahead.
It seems slightly more credible to me because slide film is much, much more difficult to alter and far more... It's far easier to see alterations to the slide than you could on regular negative film.
Yeah, no, and that's kind of the argument that Tom Carey makes, too, is that, okay, these photos would have been much more difficult to fake. Now, he's also described what the slides show. He says that they're 3.5 to 4 feet tall beings on these on this thing. He says that the head is almost insect-like in the photo. The head has been severed from the body, and there's been a partial autopsy carried out. The innards have been removed, and we believe the cadaver has been embalmed, at least at the time that the picture was taken. Now, he says he received these slides from a couple in Texas. The woman was a high-powered Midland, Texas lawyer with a pilot's license. We think she may have been involved in intelligence during World War II, and her husband was a field geologist for an oil company. Now, that's an interesting story, and that's really basically all we have right now. He says that he has the photograph. He gave this information about it. Now, apparently, Leslie Kane had, like, I think, posted on her Facebook page after the fact and said, I had nothing to do with that Roswell stuff. She's, of course, very skeptical about that and tries to distance herself from anything, but I think the historical discussion of UFOs as a prominent, an apparent phenomenon in our midst, she's very careful about associating herself with, you know, abduction and things like that. But according to what Tom Carey has said, this is confirmed by, you know, other blog posts and other information about these photographs, which I've been hearing about, you know, behind the scenes a bit for a long time. He claims that this photograph, you know, shows the real deal. Now, when will we see it? That's the question. Is this going to... Tom Carey, I think, is, you know, I don't agree with everything that he and Don Schmidt have written, but I find them to be... very credible researchers, I guess. You know, I think that their intentions are pretty good. You know, other people might dispute that, but, you know, my interactions with them have been good. But I'll tell you this. I hope this doesn't turn out to be another Melba Ketchum type situation where, oh, look at this, we've got DNA proof of Bigfoot, and that turned out to be a fiasco. I mean, the evidence that was purportedly peer-reviewed and published in a scientific journal was published in a science journal that had been purchased in coincidence with the announcement, and it was the only article that I think had ever been published by this journal, which they bought and published themselves. It was not carried out in the true, rigorous manner in which science has to be carried out.
Well, I asked the same question with in regards to the photograph. Is it ethically correct for someone to just willy-nilly release a real, honest-to-goodness, photographic piece of evidence of extraterrestrial life?
Is it ethical?
Is it ethically correct?
Now, what do you mean by that?
I
mean,
I spoke about earlier, if real live, irrefutable proof of extraterrestrials existed, there would be chaos. There would be rioting in the streets. Religious sects from all over the world would be doing things that make extremism now look like a ball pit.
Yeah. Well, now I would ask this, though. Will a photograph alone, even a good photograph that may show the real thing, will that alone be enough to convince people who are skeptical on the idea of alien life and alien alien life maybe coming to Earth and traveling here via these saucers? You know, again, I don't know how good a photograph could be in this day and age to convince people. A photograph is not a physical specimen. If you want to convince a biologist, give them a specimen that they can dissect.
Well, I think they're about 60 years too late on that.
Yeah, exactly. Although what is inferred from the photograph is that somebody dissected this. So if not, you know, if not a scientist at American, you know, universities, you know, or, you know, maybe a European agency or whatever, who would have written an article about this and then a science journal actually publishes a essay on life from another world, then who had actually carried out this autopsy and who had that information? Who had access to that body if the thing actually exists? But here's the other fundamental question. If you see something that appears to be not human, but humanoid, and it seems to be intelligent, as these photographs, Tom Carey says, purportedly show, where's your evidence that that is actually an extraterrestrial life form, you know? That's the other question I have is that, and this kind of comes around to what Mac Tonies wrote about in his book, The Crypto-Terrestrials, remember that book?
Mm-hmm.
Mac Tonies in that book posited the idea that what if there could be a presence that's indigenous to Earth? I even heard Robert Schock bring this up one time when he and I were on the cruise in January together. He I had been talking about the different potentials for where alien life might come from, and he even said, or it could be something from here on Earth or maybe from our past. Two very interesting things for Robert Schock to say in relation to discussion about UFOs and aliens. Two very good points to be raised. You know, is there any direct evidence that there is life elsewhere in the universe? We haven't seemed to be able to find that, but what if we found what appeared to be non-human intelligence? We encounter them here on Earth. Is there any possibility that whatever this technology is, whatever this intelligence is representative of a kind of clandestine Earth intelligence of some sort? Now, that's really far out, maybe even more far out and beyond the possible than ETs visiting Earth. But again, you don't have direct evidence that this thing, whatever it is actually an extraterrestrial, merely that it is a non-human entity. You know, all these questions remain. And you've got to ask these questions, I think. I think that, you know, it's unsettling for a lot of people. A lot of people think that it's absolutely absurd. But I think that, you know, as long as there appears to be a technological presence in our midst that we call UFOs, people are going to continue to say that, oh, well, it's aliens from outer space. We may not have actual proof that backs that up. And that's kind of where we're left. Now, you know, we don't have a whole lot of time to get to these other stories, but a couple of things I wanted to bring up were basically just, and we could pose these as questions. Are we sending aliens the right messages? And BBC recently, it was BBC that did an article about this that essentially posed the idea that, well, the information that we're sending out into the stars, which we would hope alien life would find and use for purpose of confirming that we're here and then they might reach out and make contact. How do we know that we're sending information? Is Chris attacks his microphone.
It just jumped out at me from nowhere.
Yeah, watch out, guy. It just does that from time to time. It's trying to be friendly. It's not like a creature or anything. But again, the question that was asked in this article was, is the information that we're putting out to potential alien species anything that is going to be, you know, discernible as communication to them? That's one question. Another question that's asked is, with regard to the alien abductions, which I think comprise a large part, if not the largest part, of the anecdotal support for extraterrestrial intervention in human lives on planet Earth, can abductions be explained as anything other than the actual physical interactions between alien visitors and human beings? There was an article that, of all places, The Blaze carried recently that was titled, Are Alien Abductions Just in People's Heads? That's what one scientist thinks. And apparently, citing a recent report from the Royal College of Anesthetists, which investigated incidents of accidental awareness that occurred during general anesthesia, the woman who is, you know, putting the idea forward that people may be imagining, essentially, the abduction experiences, wrote that alien encounters might actually be recovered memories. Interesting, because, get this, we were just talking about recovered memories on the show last week. If anything, we were taking a very skeptical stance on that. Now, in this article, the researcher is Anne Skomorowski, and she is a doctor practicing psychosomatic medicine at New York Presbyterian Hospital. Interesting that she believes that alien abductions might actually be recovered memories. She said, alien abduction has been considered a fantasy, a hoax, and even to some a fact, but it is now clear that it may also represent a recovered memory. Huh. Now, where are we to stand on this, Chris, having looked at the potential dangers of the recovered memory idea last week? If it's a recovered memory, it's a recovered memory of what? Now, obviously, she says not an alien encounter.
Well, yeah. I mean, this would be an unprompted recovered memory, unlike with the under the direct influence of hypnosis, but a drug-induced one nonetheless. And like we've discussed myriad times, it's all based on social awareness or societal awareness. If, especially now, you can't really say, I'm this person who has never been exposed to the idea of UFOs, so if you're seeing bright lights and weird doctors or things you can't explain, your mind is going to naturally grasp to the closest cultural cue you've got to go with that you can't explain, and there's no saying that that's not you having heard of alien abductions and hearing the details of alien abductions over your entire life.
Yeah. I want to come back around to an interesting story I can tell in relation to what you're talking about. I want to read one quick portion from Skomorowski's statement on this. She says, for one thing, the report discusses, and she's referring, of course, to this report that was in the Royal College of Anesthetists study, but she says the report discusses different types of memory, including trauma memory. Everyday memories are not terribly descriptive, intense emotional states. However, such as those experienced during awareness create memories that are rich in sensory detail and tend to burst out inappropriately, as maybe in a flashback. Trauma memories are not encoded as logical narratives, but as globs of sensation, and thus a sensory experience, like seeing a hospital worker in scrubs, can cause an awareness survivor to feel overwhelmed with panic and to relive the sensation of paralysis she suffered through while anesthetized. After later hearing himself speak about his encounter while under hypnosis, apparently Skomorowski writes that Barney Hill said he started feeling as if parts of my life that had been missing were added to it again, which she uses to substantiate the fact that the Hill encounter may have been a recovered memory. Now, I want to point out an interesting story that was told to me years ago by a friend who I cannot give you her name here. But she, as a matter of fact, when I interviewed her, McNonymous, Mr. McCollum of Middle Theory, was present with me. And the woman we interviewed had, I had no, pre-knowledge that she had any kind of interest in abductions or had had anything that she might liken to being an abduction experience. Why I was discussing it with her is because actually at the time I was writing an essay on purported abductions, and I had asked her, when she came to visit, this is a funny story. She was just a friend who was in town, and she said, what are you working on? And I told her, and she says, oh, that's interesting, alien abductions. And I asked her, what's your take on that? And she says, well, I don't know that I really believe, but... And then she described for me an experience where she had had to be removed from a vehicle when she had been in a car accident in her teens. And she said that after the accident, that she was not badly injured, but they had to airlift her away from the scene of the accident. And she said, I was in such shock that as I was being removed from the vehicle, she said, they put me on the stretcher and they airlifted me out. And I thought I was being beamed up into a flying saucer. And I said, really? And then she says, when they actually had me in the hospital, that she said that I tried to punch one of the doctors. I was still in such shock. And literally, I was fighting for my life to get away from them. And I said, what did you perceive happened to you in that experience? And she says, well, I know now that I was in the care of doctors and I woke up and I came to eventually. But she said, while I was in that state of panic, in that state of shock, she said, you could not have convinced me that there were not aliens that were present and that they were trying to cut my clothes off of me and rape me, is what she said. Aliens. Which is interesting, very interesting, because in that vulnerable state of mind, of course, she makes the equation or the comparison with sexual assault. And if you read, I think it was Paul Dini wrote his book Sex and the Supernatural, and where he gets into numerous accounts, especially of early abductions that all have this very sexual component to them. As a matter of fact, the Hill abduction had something of a sexual component to it just as well. And many would argue that the entire abduction phenomena on the whole has a kind of overt, maybe it's not so overt, maybe at times it's very subliminal, but that there seems to be a preoccupation with, again, the sex organs and with reproduction. And of course, this narrative of hybridization has kind of stemmed from that.
Well, even looking beyond that, the whole concept of being taken against your will somewhere, it's an overlying whole body rape. It's a rape of the soul, a rape of your will, a rape of any aspect of control you could exert.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, to me, what's interesting is that, again, with the abduction narrative, and as we looked at last week on the show, much like the idea of, the super soldiers, much like the, the kids who, again, there's I don't doubt that some of this stuff's true. Especially with regard to, things like MK Ultra, human experimentation, testing the powers of the mind, some of this stuff. No, I'm serious. I think that there's probably a component to this that is actually, logical, and had we had access to the information, that there would be, facts that backed up some of it. However, again, a lot of the MK Ultra files were destroyed. But the reason I bring that up in relation to all this is, while there may be some component to a lot of this, there is this belief among people who, again, through the utilization of these kind of recovered memories. And I wonder almost if, in relation to this alien abduction study, if Anne Skoborowski's use of the recovered memory term is somewhat different from the idea of the recovered memories that we talked about last week in relation to hypnosis. i.e. a recovered memory from a trauma experience that is actually based in fact versus a memory, quote unquote, I put up air quotes here, a memory that actually has no basis in any actual fact, but that is something that a person, through the suggestion that is presented via hypnosis, maybe is led to believe was based on real events when in fact it was not at all. You know, it's a difficult narrative that has to be broken down. But, you know, in looking at it, again, I don't rule out the possibility that maybe E.T. has visited Earth. But again, as a researcher who looks at history and facts, I have not found evidence that supports that. And that, therefore, will have to remain in the realm of speculation. Whatever the broader implications or the sources behind the UFO phenomenon actually are. And that's going to have to do it for this week's edition of the program. Chris Hayes, as always, thank you for your participation in this fine broadcast we call the Graylian Report. Dear buddy.
It's my pleasure.
Yes, of course. And thanks to all of you who tune in every week and listen. Consider checking out Graylian X if you would like a little more from the boys in the bunker. And, of course, help spread the word about what we do. Tell all your friends. Visit GraylianReport.com for daily news. And, of course, you can also log in and listen live here every week from Monday from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time. On the one and only KGRI Radio Network, and on behalf of John Anderson, Caleb Hanks, Dick Oakley, Matthew Oakley, Chris Hayes, Jeremy London, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, the Mouth of the South, we bid you adieu, my friends, and until next time, stay strange.
You've been listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GraylianReport.com.